Morning Front Pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers, the latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Is Friday, July 12th, 2024. I'm Charlie Shine, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant and the New York Times with me today is Bill Murphy. We're going to start by taking a look at the front page of the New York Times, the pictures there, and then we're going to jump over to Bill and get a look at the pictures in the front page of the Courant and get our first story. So, in the upper left-hand side of the New York Times, we have a picture of President Biden standing right underneath a NATO sign, a NATO OTAN sign, rather, in Washington. And that was yesterday. People closest to him are adamant that he will stay in the race. More on that as the broadcast rolls on. Right below the fold, we have a picture from Las Vegas, right by the iconic Las Vegas sign that says, "Welcome to fabulous Las Vegas." We've got people standing under umbrellas in the hot sunshine. "It's like being in front of an exhaust pipe," said a visitor to Las Vegas, where temperatures soared. Yes, we'll have more on that as we roll on through the broadcast. To the right of that story, we have a picture from showing Shelley Duvall in her younger days. That's from a picture starring her in Three Women from 1977. Unfortunately, she died yesterday. And we're going to have more on that as we continue with the broadcast as well. Thumbnail photos in the bottom of the page. We have a story from Diane's Drums and Songs. Activists of all ages are braving rising temperatures to protest companies that support fossil fuel projects. Actually, we'll be taking a closer look at that story a little bit later on. And from the business section, where sadly we're not going to be taking a look at anything this morning, but the thumbnail photo talking about free electric bus tests town in a tiny Wymore, Nebraska. A sleek new battery-powered school bus became a surrogate for far bigger issues. And the picture itself, you've got a photo of a kid on a bike rolling by, supposedly an electric school bus. Final photo from the weekend art section. Funny first lady on Broadway. "Oh, Mary," asked the immortal question. "Besides that, Miss Lincoln, how was the play?" Above, Cole LaScola with other star Conrad Brickamora as they play Mary and Abraham Lincoln. And it shows them in a theater booth. And that's it for the pictures in the front page of the New York Times. Now we go over to Bill and get our first story after we hear about the pictures in the front page of the Courant. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Charlie. Two pictures. Well, actually three. I'll do the smallest one first. It's a picture of a lady, a mother, Margot Parenti, and her son Nicholas. Just the two of them. They have big smiles on their faces. The story is marathon running helps mom in grieving, and we are going to have a story about that after the weather. So the main pictures, they're both related. The headline is freshening up a place of respect, and respect is in big headline black letters. I'll read the caption. A memorial to all Vernon and Rockville veterans received some sprucing up Thursday with some trimming amid a rainy and warm season that has seen plants growing fast. In these photos, and this is actually they're pretty much about the same, a seasonal worker for the town of Vernon is freshening up the walkway in front of the Fox Hill Memorial Tower, a beautiful stone tower, and he is using a leaf blower to clean up all the debris after he cut the weeds, it says. And the only other thing I can say is there are two flags flying near the tower. Now, one is an American flag. I cannot tell what the other one is. It's in the background. So those are the pictures on the front page of the Courant. We're going to go with our first story, and that'll be from the World and Nations section. From Jerusalem, the Israeli military acknowledged a string of errors in its response to the deadly Hamas attacks last October 7th, including slow response times and disorganization, as it released the results Thursday of its first investigation into failures during the assault that triggered the war in Gaza. The report focused on the border community of Be'eri, it's a B-E-E-R-I, where over 100 people were killed and more than 30 taken hostage by Hamas. It was among the hardest hit communities in the early morning attack, and it was the scene of one of the highest profile confrontations of October 7th, a standoff in which militants held a group of hostages inside a home. The army failed in its mission to protect the residents of Kibbutz Be'eri, the military's chief spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, said in a televised address. It is painful and difficult for me to say that. During the standoff, a tank fired at the home, raising concerns that the 13 hostages inside were killed by friendly fire. The military concluded that they were likely killed by Hamas militants, not Israeli shelling, although it was unclear how it reached that conclusion, and the report called for additional tests. The army said the kibbutz was overrun by about 340 Hamas fighters. Investigators determined that based on the information reviewed and to the best of their understanding, no civilians inside the building were harmed by tank shell fire, the report said, although it said two Israeli civilians were hit by shrapnel outside the building. One of those civilians died, according to the man's wife. The team determined that most of the hostages were likely murdered by the terrorists, the report said. The report also pointed to delays of several hours in the arrival of military forces and said forces waited outside the kibbutz into the afternoon. Residents were being killed, not understanding the severity of the situation. This situation is extremely grave and cannot occur, it said. The report praised the bravery of the Be'eri residents and the members of the kibbutz civilian rapid response team, saying it was crucial in stabilizing the defensive line during the first hours of combat. Charlie?
As millions watched, African intelligence routed the natural kind. From Seoul, Lee Sedol was the finest Go player of his generation when he suffered a decisive loss, defeated not by a human opponent, but by artificial intelligence. Mr. Lee was beaten by AlphaGo, an AI computer program developed by Google's DeepMind unit. The stunning upset in 2016 made headlines around the world and looked like a clear sign that artificial intelligence was entering a new, profoundly unsettling era. By besting Mr. Lee, an 8-time world champion revered for his intuitive and creative style of play, AlphaGo had solved one of computer science's greatest challenges, teaching itself the abstract strategy needed to win at Go, widely considered the world's most complex board game. I'm very surprised because I've never thought I would lose, Mr. Lee said at the time in a post-match news conference. I didn't know that AlphaGo would play such a perfect Go. But the implications of his loss went far beyond the game itself, in which two players compete for territory by placing black and white stones on a gridded board made up by 19 lines by 19 lines. AlphaGo's victory demonstrated the unbridled potential of AI to achieve superhuman mastery of skills once considered too complicated for machines. Mr. Lee, now 41, retired 3 years later, convinced that humans could no longer compete with computers at Go. Artificial intelligence, he said, had changed the very nature of a game that originated in China more than 2,500 years ago. Losing to AI, in a sense, meant my entire world was collapsing, he said in a recent interview with the New York Times. As a society wrestles with what AI holds for humanity's future, Mr. Lee is now urging others to avoid being caught unprepared, as he was, and to become familiar with the technology now. He delivers lectures about AI, trying to give others the advance notice he wishes he'd received before his match. I faced issues of AI early, but It will happen for others, Mr. Lee said recently at a community education fair in Seoul to a crowd of students and parents. It may not be a happy ending. Since his loss, Mr. Lee has become an AI obsessive of sorts, following with rapt, if not uneasy, attention as artificial intelligence delivers one breakthrough after another. AI has helped chatbots carry on conversations almost indistinguishable from human interaction. It has solved problems that have confounded scientists for decades, like predicting protein shapes. It has blurred the lines of creativity, writing music, producing art, and generating videos. Mr. Lee is not a doomsayer. In his view, AI may replace some jobs, but it may create some, too. When considering AI's grasp of Go, he said it was important to remember that humans both created the game and designed the AI system that mastered it. What he worries about is that AI may change what humans value. People used to be in awe of creativity, originality, and innovation, he said, but since AI came, a lot of that has disappeared.
Thank you, Charlie. The story on the front page of The Current from Washington. President Joe Biden's ability to run for re-election faced crucial tests Thursday as he prepared for questions at a highly anticipated news conference and his team met privately with skeptical senators on Capitol Hill. More House Democrats called for him to exit the race, and he made a notable flub ahead of the news conference in announcing a compact that would bring together NATO countries to support Ukraine. He referred to Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, as President Putin to audible gasps in the room. He quickly returned to the microphone, President Putin, he's going to beat Putin, Biden said. Then he said, I'm so focused on beating Putin in an effort to explain the gaffe. I'm better, Zelensky replied. And to that, Biden said back, you're a hell of a lot better. The Biden campaign laid out what it sees as its path to keeping the White House in a new memo saying that winning the blue wall states of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan is the clearest pathway to victory. And it declared no other Democrat would do better against Republican Donald Trump. Biden will head to Detroit on Friday. But Thursday was pivotal. Biden must show skeptics during his whirlwind day with world leaders at NATO and the evening news conference that he is up for another 4 years. Voters are watching and elected officials are deciding whether to press for another choice. It all comes as Democrats are facing an integral problem. Top donor supporters and key lawmakers are doubtful of Biden's abilities to carry on his reelection bid after his recent debate performance, but the hard-fighting 81-year-old president refuses to give up as he prepares to take on Trump in a rematch. There is also no indication that anyone else would outperform the president versus Trump, said the memo from campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon and campaign manager Julie Chavez Rodriguez that was obtained by the Associated Press. Charlie?
Body found on melting Peru peak after 22 years, two decades after Bill Stamfi went missing during an avalanche while climbing Peru's highest mountain. His daughter Jennifer Stamfi had more or less accepted that he was gone forever. Sometimes she still had dreams about him alive in Peru, amnesiac and unaware that he had a family in the United States. She knew that he hated the cold, so the idea of his being trapped in ice was unsettling. But she thought she had made her peace with the mountain keeping her father. Then, one Saturday last month, she got a call from her brother, Joseph Stamfi. He began, "Are you sitting down?" "He told me that they found Dad," she said, and I said, "What?" A fellow American, Ryan Cooper, had tracked down Joseph Stamfi to tell him that he and a group of climbers had stumbled upon his father's body on a 22,000-foot peak in the Andes Range. As climate change helped melt the mountain's glaciers, Bill Stamfi's body emerged from the ice that had preserved it since he went missing during an expedition with two friends in 2002, the Peruvian police said on Tuesday. On June 27th, the climbers were descending Husacaran when they saw a dark shape that stood out against the snow. Mr. Cooper, 44, a personal trainer from Las Vegas, said in an interview on Tuesday, As they drew closer, they saw that it was a body curled in a defensive position like someone was trying to protect himself during an avalanche, he said. The body was completely exposed atop the ice, Mr. Cooper said. Not like the half of him was under the ice or anything. He was on top of the ice, he said. Judging by the outdated clothing and the mummified condition of the skin, Mr. Cooper said, it was clear that the body had been there for a really long time. In a fanny pack, they found a still-legible ID card and passport. Mr. Cooper and his brother, the only two Americans in the group, knew that they had to find and notify Mr. Stamfee's family, Cooper said. He still had his wedding ring on his finger, so I knew he was married, and I knew he probably had a family, and somebody was expecting him home at some point, and he didn't come home. It was by sheer coincidence that Mr. Cooper's group had stumbled upon the body. His group tried to make it to the summit, but turned around after determining that the conditions were too dangerous. On the way down, they took an older route that's rarely used now because of how the environment of the mountain had changed, he said. Mr. Cooper was initially deeply disappointed by failing to make it to the summit, he said, but after things worked out the way they did, I realized I wasn't meant to summit, he said. I was meant to find Bill. Before the group had even finished descending, Mr. Cooper contacted his wife in Los Angeles to help track down Mr. Stamfee's family. With the help of old newspaper articles, they began to piece together the story of his disappearance. 2 days after discovering the body, Mr. Cooper was on the phone with Joseph Stamfee, now 51. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. This story on the front page of The Current. A new report paints a discouraging picture of Connecticut's competitiveness in attracting new businesses and residents when it comes to its taxes, placing it near the bottom when compared with states across the country. The Tax Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, ranked Connecticut 47th overall on an index that analyzes how well states fare against each other in five major tax categories: corporate tax, individual income tax, sales tax, property tax, and unemployment insurance tax. Only California, New York, and New Jersey ranked lower. Connecticut's northern neighbor, Massachusetts, did fare much better, coming in at 46th. Connecticut is pretty low on our index, Audrey Shufkov, a senior policy analyst at the foundation, said. And unfortunately, it has traditionally been so because we believe Connecticut is not super competitive, neither among its geographic neighbors or nationally, Yushkov said. The foundation has been performing its analysis for more than two decades. In addition to an overall competitiveness ranking, each of the tax categories are also ranked by state. For Connecticut, property taxes and the individual income tax are the most problematic when it comes to the foundation's rankings, Yushkov said. The individual income tax comes in at 46 among all states, while property taxes are ranked dead last. As of January 1st, Connecticut did cut its individual income tax for the first time since the mid-1990s. The cuts are estimated to benefit about 1 million individual filing state income tax returns. Taxes have long been a subject of debate in Connecticut, with ideas pitched for increasing taxes, rats for the rich, phasing out the, no, it's, I'm sorry, it says rats here, but I think they meant rates. They've got to spell R-A-T-S. Yeah. I think it was rates. Phasing out the car tax and looking for ways to make the overall tax burden more equitable. The January 1st tax cuts came in the two lowest rates. The 3% rate on the first $10,000 earned by single filers and the first $20,000 by joint filers dropped to 2%. In addition, the 5% rate on the next $40,000 by single filers and the next $80,000 by joint filers dropped to 4.5%. It is approximately 19 minutes past the top of the hour. That means it's time for the weather. Charlie will give us the national forecast from the New York Times, and I will give you the local forecast.
The national forecast from the New York Times: heavy rain from thunderstorms will pose a risk for flash flooding from central New Jersey to northern South Carolina today. Thunderstorms may form farther west from eastern Pennsylvania to the western Carolinas with a lower risk of flooding. Much of lower Michigan, Ohio, Missouri, and northern Arkansas are expected to have thunderstorms. Afternoon thunderstorms are likely along the Gulf Coast. Thunderstorms may be more numerous and occur any time in the central Florida peninsula. Thunderstorms may bring flash flooding and damaging wind gusts from central and southeastern Arizona to western New Mexico. Record-challenging heat will continue in parts of the West.
Hi, this is Beth Bradley, inviting you to join us weekday afternoons at 3 or anytime online and on demand for USA Today on Chris.
And the weather, the local weather, first is a flood watch in effect from July 13th, that's tomorrow, 5 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, until July 13th, tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Now, the detailed forecast for today, a chance of showers with thunderstorms also possible. Partly sunny with a high near 88. Chance of precipitation is 30%. Tonight, a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a low around 72. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Saturday, showers and possibly a thunderstorm. Some of the storms could produce heavy rainfall. High near 85, chance of precipitation is 80%. Saturday night, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy, with a low around 69, chance of precipitation is 30%. Sunday, sunny with a high near 92, and Sunday night, mostly clear with a low around 70.
Record heat persists as we continue with our weather theme, stunning even forecasters. From Las Vegas, for their anniversary road trip through the West and escape from the humid misery of a Louisiana summer, Tyson and Adeline Maddox rented a glimmering convertible. They have kept the top on. It has been too hot to do anything else. Reminds me of the engine room, Mr. Maddox grumbled of the weather as he left the Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign on Wednesday evening when temperatures were still well into the triple digits. The heat, it's constantly coming, Ms. Maddox added later. It's like being in front of an exhaust pipe. So it has been around the Los Angeles area this week. Pedestrians sometimes felt scarcer than jackpots. Playgrounds stood empty and silent. Merely walking through a parking lot meant squinting, not at the sunlight blanketing the region, but at a heat so punishing that eyes hurt without actually ever watering. At times, the mercury ticks upward have come so fast that forecasters, at once awestruck and unnerved, could hardly keep up. Remember 20 minutes ago when hitting 117 degrees Fahrenheit was a big deal? The local National Weather Service office wrote on social media on Wednesday. Well, the airport hit 118. Thursday was not shaping up to be much of a reprieve at all. More than 60 million Americans were under heat alerts from the National Weather Service on Thursday as a searing heat wave that has engulfed the West for more than a week continued to blister the region. Dangerously high temperatures are forecast to last through Saturday and shift east to the central and eastern U.S. by Sunday. In southeast Texas, where Hurricane Beryl left millions of residents without power on Monday, people sweltered without air conditioning, and Houston area hospitals were backed up because doctors were wary of discharging patients to homes without power, officials said Wednesday. By Thursday afternoon, nearly 1.1 million CenterPoint Energy customers were still without electricity as a heat index in Houston pushed towards 98. The company said that it hoped to get the lights back on for 400,000 customers by the end of today, but that about 500,000 customers would probably still be without power into next week. Across the West, large parts of California, Nevada, Arizona, and Utah were under excessive heat warnings, indicating extremely dangerous heat conditions. Officials believe that heat may be to blame for more than 90 deaths reported in the West this month, though it could take months of investigations for the authorities to determine on an accurate death toll. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. This story on the front page of The Current. The warm weather is bringing out Connecticut snakes, including one of its two venomous species, the often spectacular but shy copperhead. It's more visible these days because most people who will come across it are those who climb on the state's trap rock ridges, say the experts. Chuck Anicelli, owner of Herpetological Surveys in North Haven, said snakes in general are more in the public view right now. People are seeing a lot of snakes and reporting a lot of snakes right now. It's kind of like a banner year, if you will. He said that's because there was a massive acorn fall in November, which fattened up the rodents. Copperheads, a pit viper, seek mice and small rodents. They can also eat other reptiles, amphibians, small birds, and insects, according to state experts. Thankfully, unless you're a mouse, shrew, or chipmunk, the northern copperhead's population is low but stable, said Jenny Dixon, acting Bureau Chief of Natural Resources for the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. The weather has been obviously very warm, very nice, Dixon said. Snakes, being cold-blooded, are coming out to warm up in the morning. People are recreating because the weather's recreating, I should say, because the weather's been nice, so they're seeing them a little bit more than they usually would, she said. On the other hand, copperheads' coloring is what Dixon calls cryptic, meaning they actually blend in with the background really well, she said. Those hourglass shapes and the color differences make them just disappear into leaf litter on the ground or red sandstone on a trap rock ridge. It can make them very hard for people to spot. Charlie?
Biden's isolation deepens as doubters' ranks grow. Even some of his own aides are weighing on how to persuade him to drop out. From Washington, President Biden found himself increasingly isolated on Thursday as a small group of his longtime aides and advisors have become convinced that he will have to make what they see as a painful but inevitable decision to abandon his campaign for re-election, according to three people who've been briefed on the matter. In recent days, the group has been trying to come up with ways to persuade Mr. Biden to step aside from the campaign. Those discussions were recounted by three people familiar with them who, like others in the article, spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive situation. There's no indication that any of the discussions have reached Mr. Biden himself, one of the informed people said. The effort comes after a disastrous debate performance in Atlanta two weeks ago plunged Mr. Biden's candidacy into crisis. He's facing pressure from all sides. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are vacillating between tepid support and outright calls for him to drop out, and those calls being echoed by some of the wealthiest donors in the party. At the center of it all is Mr. Biden, who is convinced that he's the only one who can beat former President Donald J. Trump, according to people familiar with this thinking, who is unlikely to be persuaded otherwise by people outside of his insular inner circle, which includes his family. Mr. Biden was hoping to put some concerns to rest in a high-stakes news conference on Thursday night after the NATO summit in Washington. In an early stumbling before it got underway, he flubbed his introduction of President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin." After a moment, Mr. Biden realized his mistake and came back to the microphone and quickly said, "President Putin, we're going to beat President Putin, President Zelensky. I'm focused on beating Putin. We've got to worry about it." A small group of Mr. Biden's advisors in the administration and the campaign, at least two of whom have told allies they do not believe he should keep trying to run for a second term, said they would need to convince the president of several things for him to leave the race. They said that they would have to make the case that he cannot win against Mr. Trump. They would have to convince him that another candidate like Vice President Kamala Harris could beat Mr. Trump. And they would have to assure Mr. Biden that should he step aside, the process to choose another candidate would be orderly and not devolve into chaos in the Democratic Party. The internal deliberations reflect a growing standoff between Mr. Biden and his party since his disastrous debate performance, Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. This story on the front page of The Current. In May 2022, Margot Parenti's son, Nicholas, was diagnosed with an aggressive form of brain cancer. He was only 7 years old. The cancer advanced rapidly, and Nicholas died that August. It was a devastating blow for Parenti, her husband Robert, and her older son Alexander, who live in Bristol. Some of her friends suggested running as a way to cope with the loss. Maybe she could train for a half marathon to attempt to heal and process her grief. A year ago in July, she ran her first road race, and in October, she ran her first half marathon at the Eversource Hartford Marathon. The half marathon piqued my interest because it was something I'd never do on my own, Parenti said. I would run in our neighborhood every so often. I had dabbled in track and field in high school, but I was a soccer player. But running, it wasn't something I really enjoyed. But I was like, you know, it's not outside the realm of possibility, so why not? And we're going to stop there. It is approximately 30 minutes past the top of the hour. Charlie and I will be back with more of the front pages after that.
Hi, I'm Rick Gray, a Chris Radio volunteer. Chris wants you to know that the Connecticut affiliate of the American Diabetes Association provides programs for diabetics, their families, and anyone affected by diabetes. Programs include support services, education, youth activities, public awareness, and professional offerings. Meetings are held throughout the state. For more information, call 800-842-6323. That's 800-842-6323. Or call the state info line at 211.
Our next story, Shelley Duvall, born 1949, died this year, actually within this week. Queen of Quirk, who put dread in The Shining. Shelley Duvall, whose lightsome features and quirky screen personality made her one of the biggest film stars of the 1970s and early 80s, appearing in a string of movies by the director Robert Altman, perhaps most memorably opposite Jack Nicholson in The Shining, died on Thursday at her home in Blanco, Texas. She was 75. A family spokesman said that the cause was complications of diabetes. Ms. Duvall wasn't planning on a film career when she met Mr. Altman, who was filming Brewster McCloud in 1970. She'd thrown a party to sell her husband's artwork, and members of his film crew were in attendance. Taken with her, they introduced her to Mr. Altman, a director with his own reputation for oddball movies and offbeat casting. He immediately asked her to join the cast, despite her lack of training. She said yes and went on to appear in an unbroken string of five more Altman movies: McCabe and Mrs. Miller, 1971, Thieves Like Us, 1974, Nashville, 1975, Buffalo Bill and the Indians, or Sitting Bull's History Lesson, 1976, Three Women from 1977. She starred as Olive Oil opposite Robin Williams in Mr. Altman's Popeyes in 1980. I thought, boy, if it's this easy, why doesn't everybody act? Ms. Duvall told the New York Times in April. Her work with Mr. Altman cemented her career with her gossamer frame, toothy smile, and soft southern twang. She was the go-to actress for any role, calling for an idiosyncratic woman. Fans called her the Texas Twiggy, the quick critic Pauline Kael, praising her understated physicality on screen, called her the female Buster Keaton. Ms. Duvall dated Paul Simon and Ringo Starr. She hosted Saturday Night Live in 1977. Photos of her often wearing a draping sheer dress, holding a cigarette almost as long and thin as she was, became an enduring image of 1970s celebrity life. But it was her appearance as Wendy Torrance in The Shining in 1980 that for many viewers remains her most memorable role. In that movie, she and her husband, Mr. Nicholson, along with their son, Danny Lloyd, moved into a mountainside hotel as caretakers while it shut down for the winter. As Jack begins to exhibit signs of madness, Wendy becomes increasingly concerned for her own safety and her son's, though she seems to remain unaware of the underlying supernatural forces at work on her husband. Critics initially found her performance overbearing, especially her shrieks as an axe-wielding Mr. Nicholson hunts them through the hotel halls. She was nominated for a Razzie Award for Worst Actress, though Janet Maslin, writing in the Times, praised her Wendy as an almost freakish cipher, her early banality making her terror all the more extreme. Ms. Duvall's role has since been reevaluated, especially as critics have come to understand the psychological strain of working under the sometimes difficult treatment of the film's director, Stanley Kubrick. What struck viewers at the time as a stock portrait of a hysterical woman, Stephen King, who wrote the novel on which the film was based, called her role misogynistic. has come to be seen as a shockingly realistic portrait of a woman trapped in an abusive relationship. While Nicholson dials up his familiar manic mode as much as demanded, Shelley Duvall amplifies her neurotic quality to the extreme. Se-young Cho wrote for RogerEbert.com in 2023, her strenuous efforts here in this film deserve more appreciation, especially considering how Kubrick harshly treated her during the shooting. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. The rest of our stories are going to come from the Connecticut section of the Current. A New Canaan woman was arrested Thursday for allegedly sexually assaulting a student while she worked as a guidance counselor at a middle school in Norwalk. Luisa Melchione, 47, faces one count of second-degree sexual assault and two counts of risk of injury to a minor, according to Sergeant Ryan Everts of the Norwalk Police Department. Everts said police in April began investigating after receiving a complaint about a Norwalk Public Schools employee allegedly having an inappropriate relationship with a student. The police department's special victims unit took over the investigation and alleged that Melchione was, quote, sexually involved, unquote, with a male student while serving as a guidance counselor at Nathan Hale Middle School, Everts said. Everts said police obtained a warrant for Melchione's arrest. He noted that at the time of her arrest, she was no longer employed by the school system. Melchione was held on a $500,000 bond and was expected to appear before a judge on Thursday. Norwalk Public Schools issued a statement Thursday saying in part that the, quote, safety of our students is our first concern, unquote. Luisa Melchione is no longer employed by Norwalk Public Schools as of June 14th, the school system wrote. Norwalk Public Schools is cooperating with the Norwalk Police Department's investigation and has no further comment. According to the warrant affidavit supporting Melchione's arrest, a man contacted the police department on April 24th and reported that a friend who identified as Melchione had lent him a cell phone that allegedly contained messages that appeared inappropriate. The man was hesitant to identify himself, but said the messages appeared to be between a student and who he erroneously said was a teacher. The man later emailed police screenshots of the message conversations, which allegedly included multiple photos that appeared to be exchanged, including one showing a nude woman. The warrant affidavit said some of the photos allegedly showed a boy who police were able to identify as a local student. According to the warrant affidavit, a school resource officer was reportedly able to identify the woman in the photos as Melchione. The resource officer also told a detective she had allegedly seen children enter Melchione's office and close the door, the warrant affidavit said. Charlie?
A Long Island suburb is training an armed force. Is it a militia? Excuse me. Is it a militia? The leader of a New York City suburb is recruiting 75 armed citizens, many of them former police officers, for a force of, quote, special deputies, unquote, to be activated whenever he chooses. Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, a Republican who's allied himself with former President Donald J. Trump, has thrust himself into the culture wars, posted a call in March for residents with gun permits and an interest in becoming, quote, provisional emergency special deputy sheriffs, unquote. The posting called the initiative a strategy to assist, quote, in the protection of human life and property during an emergency, unquote, such as a hurricane or blackout, and perhaps, Mr. Blakeman added, quote, a riot, unquote. The new force has drawn vocal opposition in this well-to-do Long Island County, which is one of the country's safest, protected by one of the largest police departments. It has plunged Nassau into a national debate about authoritarianism in an election season that some see as a fork in the road for American democracy. Mr. Blakeman said in an interview that the program was about, quote, providing another layer of protection, unquote, for residents. I didn't want to be in a situation where we had a major emergency and we needed help and people were not properly vetted or trained, he said. But critics have accused him of creating, with little notice or explanation, an unsanctioned militia answering only to him. They call the move especially dangerous and heighten fears of political violence as Mr. Trump promulgates plans for mass deportations and quashing dissent. Sabat Margolis, an IT programmer manager from Great Neck, said that Mr. Blakeman was using a pretext of an emergency response team to create, quote, a clandestine armed presence. Her online petition called to stop Bruce Blakeman's personal Nassau County militia has received more than 2,600 signatures, and opponents have held rallies, pillaring both the program and the lack of details on training, scope of recruitment, and parameters of the deputy's duties. Mr. Blakeman dismissed criticism that the program is politically motivated, but has provoked a more forceful reaction than his previous provocations. He has rallied against bail reform, migrants, and mask mandates, has called Democrats like Governor Kathy Hochul soft on crime, and portrayed Nassau County as being besieged by lawlessness, and used neighboring New York City as a cautionary example. But Mr. Blakeman's opponents say that giving police powers to citizens, to civilian gun owners, could result in accidental shootings and is implied threat to minorities and political enemies.
Thank you, Charlie. More than 6 months after grocery store chain Aldi signed a lease to open a new store in Plainville, construction has yet to begin. The German-owned company signed a long-term lease back in January to rent just over 22,000 square feet of space inside Connecticut Commons Shopping Plaza at 282 New Britain Avenue, according to the commercial realtor that finalized the transaction. The grocery store will fill the space left vacant by the former arts and crafts store, A.C. Moore, after it closed in 2019. But Aldi has yet to submit permits for approval from the town. The initial permits that were applied by the landlord for a new tenant in the space were approved, said Kevin Ouellette, office assistant with the building department. We received a permit application for renovation work, but that's still in review and hasn't been issued yet. We're still waiting on information for who the general contractor is that Aldi decided to go with for construction. The trade permits electrical, HVAC, have not been applied for yet because they usually come after a contractor is selected. The store is set to feature Aldi's typical offerings, including meat, dairy, dry goods, produce, and frozen foods, and will have a new storefront and sign. In a Facebook post on the Connecticut Scoop, it was announced that Aldi is slated to begin construction work in August with an opening set for winter. But Ouellette said he could not confirm how quickly those permits will be approved. Site Centers, the commercial realtor investment company that owns the shopping plaza, confirmed the store is slated to open sometime later this winter. I can't confirm the permits will be issued by August, Ouellette said. There is no set timeline. The supermarket chain already has locations in neighboring Southington, Bristol, and New Britain. The location will compete locally with Big Y World Class Market, which sits adjacent to the plaza across the street. The town's other grocery store, Gnazzo's, is family-run and has been a staple in the town for decades. The vacant space was originally slated to be a 40,000-square-foot Amazon Fresh grocery store, but those plans fell apart after the company pulled its permit application, according to the town. Another two proposed Amazon Fresh locations in Brookfield and Westport were also scrapped after Amazon withdrew its plans last minute. Even with Aldi filling part of the space, an additional 17,000 square feet of space remains vacant, according to Site Centers. Charlie?
While Biden praises NATO, Trump deprecates the 75-year-old alliance. As NATO leaders gathered in Washington this week, one American president hailed the 75-year-old defensive alliance as the greatest in the history of the world, quote, unquote. Another described it as a virtual protection racket and declared that he would abandon the delinquent members to the mercies of Russian invaders. President Biden was the official host, greeting his European and North American counterparts in Washington with smiles, handshakes, and solidarity, posing for grip-and-grin pictures, and boasting of the progress and principle underlying the historic partnership. Former President Donald J. Trump was nowhere to be seen, not part of the formal events, but adding his voice from afar at a rally and in an interview. The fact that NATO remains a bulwark of global security did not happen by accident, Mr. Biden said at an opening ceremony in the Andrew W. Mellon Auditorium, where the North Atlantic Treaty was signed in 1949. It wasn't inevitable. Again and again, at critical moments, we choose unity over disunion and progress over retreat, freedom over tyranny, and hope over fear. Again and again, we stood behind our shared vision of a peaceful and prosperous transatlantic community. Just 2 hours after Mr. Biden finished, Mr. Trump took the stage at a campaign event in Doral, Florida, and denigrated the alliance. He made no mention of its contributions to history, its victory in the Cold War, or its role in defending Europe today as the war in Ukraine continues. Indeed, he acknowledged that he had been largely ignorant about the organization until he became president, but then he boasted about how he berated the allies. "I didn't know what the hell NATO was too much before," Mr. Trump told cheering supporters, "but it didn't take me long to figure it out, like about 2 minutes. And the first thing I figured out was that they were not paying. We were paying almost fully for NATO. And I said, that's unfair." He went on to repeat a story that he told in February to the shock of world leaders, claiming that as president, he had warned his NATO counterparts that he would not defend them if they did not increase their own military spending. "Would you protect us?" Mr. Trump quoted another leader whose country did not meet the spending target as saying, "I said, no, I will not protect you from Russia." Every recent American president has pressed NATO allies to spend more of their own armed forces, but Mr. Trump is the only one who ever threatened to let them be attacked by Russia. The notion that the United States would abrogate its mutual defense obligations under Article 5 of the NATO's treaty has roiled the alliance. During his term in the White House, Mr. Trump came close more than once to pulling the United States out of NATO altogether, only to be talked out of it by his advisors. But if he is elected again, he will not have the same advisors around him, and he may not need to even formally withdraw effectively to gut the alliance, since Article 5 would no longer be viewed as inviolate. President Trump, even to this day, does not understand that NATO is an alliance among democracies that believes in values, said Michael McFaul, director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University and a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. "It is not a protection racket. They don't pay us to protect them." Indeed, as he has done repeatedly over the years, Mr. Trump distorted how NATO works, making it sound as the allies were supposed to pay the U.S., when in fact an issue has been how much each member is to spend on its own military. And while his browbeating may have been one reason some members did increase their investments during his tenure, he overstated how much progress has been made. We'll be back after this.
In sitcoms, when someone has a problem, they just blurt it out and move on.
"Well, I lost my job and my parakeet is missing. How was your day?"
But the real world is different. Managing life's challenges can be overwhelming. So, what do? We get support. The Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council have mental health resources available for you at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. See how much further you can go when you take care of your mental health.
Canada's split on drug decriminalization as a way to stop fatal overdoses. From Vancouver, British Columbia, the mood was cautiously optimistic and the message was simple. Drug decriminalization saves lives. People who used or carried small quantities of illegal drugs in plain sight would no longer face arrest in British Columbia, the nexus of Canada's opioid crisis, officials announced 2 years ago. So bold was the experiment, even in a province known for pioneering addiction policies, its public health officer said she was in disbelief that the day had come. But decriminalization, a policy introduced as a way of alleviating the opioid crisis, has instead been blamed for deepening it. Scenes of people openly using drugs on city streets have led several elected leaders over other critics and even some supporters to say that decriminalization is contributing to a sense of public disorder. "Our goal was to save lives," British Columbia's Premier David Elby said at a recent news conference. But that compassion, that concern for people who are struggling, does not mean that anything goes. We still have expectations around safety. In May, the federal government, which regulates controlled substances, approved a provincial request to reverse the policy and, again, make public drug use and possession in British Columbia a crime. The shift came not long after a similar experiment in Oregon ended in April, following a vote by the state legislature to recriminalize drugs and soaring overdose deaths. The battle in British Columbia reflects a broader debate over how to tackle the opioid crisis in the face of a loss of support for some progressive practices to address it. Those practices, collectively known as harm reduction, are driven by a strategy meant to keep the drug users alive rather than getting them to quit. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. Nahelle Helly, that's her name, a Bridgeport mother of three, went to the grocery store early on June 1st to stock up on groceries for the month with a newly reloaded EBT card. But by 7 a.m., the account was empty, wiped out by an unknown thief. The theft of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, also known as SNAP, benefits or food stamps, jumped from $132,455 in the 2023 fiscal year to $2,584,662 in fiscal year 2024. According to State Department of Social Services data, a 1,800% increase. The number of thefts reported grew from 177 in January to 2,855 in June. It is absolutely unconscionable that criminals believe it is appropriate to steal benefits from our constituents, DSS Commissioner Andrea Barton Reeves said at a recent press conference. SNAP benefits are essential for our families to live with the dignity they deserve. These benefits are critical to their lives. Criminals commonly obtain EBT card information, the card number, and the owner's PIN code through skimming devices placed on top of the point-of-sale device. Connecticut DSS Deputy Director Communications Christine Stewart told the Connecticut Mirror, because the cards have no microchips, which are used to protect most common credit and debit cards, the card's information gets transmitted to the criminals and entered into a larger national web of stolen EBT card information. Other times, victims receive phishing text messages and emails saying that their card has been locked or needs to be reauthorized. After victims put in their card information, the data goes directly to the criminals. Once the card is reloaded at the beginning of the next month, the benefits are vulnerable to theft. The recipients wait for their benefits to be reloaded at the beginning of the month, and before these unsuspecting people wake up in the morning, their benefits are gone. It shows that this person has made purchases in a totally different state, Stewart said. The information obtained through the skimming device and phishing scams can be embedded into fraudulent cards or used to make online purchases. Although the number of theft reports was increasing in June, data from the first few days of July suggests that the problems might be waning. The majority of reports are received within the first few days of the month, and the number dropped to 460 for the first week of July. The DSS says the decrease is indicative of the effectiveness of its education and awareness campaign, which includes informational videos on how to change PIN codes and best practices for purchasing food with an EBT card. Charlie?
Protesting the backers of big oil with die-ins, drums, and song. Hundreds of activists descend on New York to turn up the heat. They slather SPF 50 plus on their toddlers' legs under scorching sun before breaking out into song. They march joyously through the canyons of the financial district while banging drums. The oldest among them lie down on the burning hot pavement and allow themselves to be dragged away by police. Over the course of a blistering summer in New York, hundreds of activists have been assembling day after day to draw attention to the main thing that's driving up global temperatures, the burning of coal, oil, and gas, which produces heat-trapping gases and makes heat waves more intense and more frequent. "Feel how hot it is," said Leslie Stevens, 70, who joined a demonstration on Wednesday. "This is not a one-time thing. We're going to burn ourselves collectively." The protest movement calls itself Summer of Heat on Wall Street, and its main target is Citigroup, which, according to a recent report by a coalition of environmental groups, is pouring the most money into new oil and gas projects worldwide. Citi has set its own climate neutrality targets for 2050, but like other big U.S. banks, Citi's investment portfolio is at odds with global goals to limit global temperature increases, according to Ceres, a advocacy group that works with businesses on their climate plans. Banks have disputed the report's methodology and findings. An analysis by Bloomberg News determined that Citi was not the biggest provider of loans to oil, gas, and coal, and that its lending to the fossil fuel sector has steadily declined. The activist tactics have spanned a wide range from low-octane read-along events with toddlers to boisterous blockades and disciplined civil disobedience actions. Though big climate demonstrations had been fairly regular in New York City and elsewhere, they've taken a backseat to demonstrations against the war in Gaza. The climate action on Wednesday was a tame, child-friendly event. Preschoolers and parents sang songs and licked red and white blue popsicles. "Give the biggest bad guy a timeout," one placard read. "Just seeing the amount of people who have been made unalive because of the climate crisis already," Shanika Anderson, a 41-year-old preschool teacher, said before explaining in a whisper that she was reluctant to use words like kill around her 4-year-old son, Sage. "We need to do something now. You can't just stay at home," Rachel Cole, 39, an artist from Brooklyn who came Wednesday with her husband and 2-year-old, adding that she'd been kept up at night worrying about the worsening heat waves and the presidential election. "I want to ensure a livable future for my son, Bill."
Thank you, Charlie. This is our final story. It's from Rome, the Knights of Columbus, an influential Catholic charitable organization, announced Thursday it will cover up its mosaics made by a famous ex-Jesuit artist accused of abusing women as a sign of solidarity with victims of abuse. After studying the issue, the Knights said they would, for now, place fabric over the mosaics at its shrine in Washington, D.C., and at the chapel of its headquarters in New Haven. A permanent plaster covering may be in order depending on the outcome of the Vatican's investigation into the Reverend Marco Rupnik, the group said in a statement. Rupnik, a charismatic Slovene, has been accused by over 20 women of psychological, spiritual, and sexual abuses over decades. But the Vatican and the Jesuits long ignored their complaints until they burst into public domain in late 2022. The decision by the Knights to cover their mosaics marks the first announcement by a major church organization or diocese to heed victims' requests to cover or remove the works that are in the public domain. And we have the lottery numbers for Thursday, July 11th. Play 3-day, 407, WB2. Play 4-day, 4654, WB2. Wednesday's late numbers, play 3-night, 055, WB4. Play 4-night, 9529, WB7. Cash 5 numbers, 210, 11, 16, and 21. Lucky for life, 2, 14, 19, 22, 36, LB9. The Powerball numbers, 7, 11, 12, 27, 46, PB26, PP3. Tonight's estimated Lotto jackpot, $4.4 million. Tonight's estimated Mega Billions jackpot, $203 million. And Saturday's estimated Powerball jackpot, $54 million. And on this date, July 12th, in 1543, England's King Henry VIII married his sixth and final wife, Catherine Parr. In 1862, during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln signed a bill authorizing the Army Medal of Honor.
And that's all for this edition of the Front Pages. We've been reading from today's Hartford Courant and New York Times. Your readers have been Bill Murphy. My name is Charlie Shine. If you missed any part of this program, it's repeated this evening at 6 and 11, and it's available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great day and a fantastic weekend.